Kevin Schultz teaches 20th century American history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. In his new book, Buckley and Mailer, The Difficult Friendship That Shaped the 60s, he delves into the fascinating relationship between William F. Buckley and Norman Mailer, and the relationship between these two controversial men, detailing their lively conversations, their heated confrontations, and their mutual admiration. Again, the title of the book is Buckley and Mailer, and we welcome Kevin Schultz to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to investigate the friendship between these two very interesting men who I'm sure could certainly fill several volumes on their own?
Well, I'd obviously heard of both William F. Buckley and Norman Mailer, and Buckley, the firebrand of the right, who was all over the place and in the media, on TV and in magazines, and Norman Mailer, the great novelist and activist on the left. And in about 2011, I was flipping through a magazine, and they had just collected a bunch of letters of Norman Mailer's. And this magazine happened to post some of the letters, and I read through, and there's one letter that just sparkled, and it was one from Norman Mailer to William F. Buckley. And you could just see the obvious intimacy, the obvious friendship that the two men had, but also latent in that sort of playful intellectual life that they had were deep ideas about the 1960s and deep thoughts about what was going on in that controversial decade. So I saw this and I wondered if there was more, and I went to the archives, and sure enough, I got to tell the story of the 1960s through the lens of these two just fascinating, brilliant thinkers.
How did they first meet?
They knew of each other, of course, in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And in fact, Buckley had called Mailer a moral pervert in the pages of National Review. But they actually first met face-to-face in 1962 at a debate brought together in Chicago that was timed actually 2 days before a big heavyweight boxing match. So all the sort of pomp and circumstance of a boxing match was going on in Chicago at the time, and there was a young promoter who wanted to bring the two radical on the left and the radical on the right together 2 days before this boxing match. So they were slated to have this big public debate in Chicago, and it was really treated like the sort of appetizer before the main event of this boxing match. There were all sorts of people there rooting them on as they debated one another. And what was fascinating about the debate, not only did it sort of shine a light on this really interesting moment in American intellectual life, late 1962. But also, over the course of the debate, you can watch the two men. They start off really playfully making fun of each other, and over the course of the debate, they sort of respect each other. They begin to see each other as having some valid arguments, some interesting perspective, and even though no one imagined that this sort of the left and the right would sort of have this much common ground, they both learned to like each other, and the friendship sort of took off after that. There were dinner invitations. They even went sailing shortly thereafter. So a friendship really started to blossom.
Given that background of what you just described and how so many of their encounters would be, for want of a better term, staged, In reading the book, you get an idea that when they were together, they were putting on a show a little bit, and they were playing parts.
Yeah, that's true to an extent. They both knew that they were public men and public figures, and they knew that everything they said was going to be recorded or be reported in the newspapers. So they sort of accepted that role. I mean, they sort of craved that role, too, to be what we would call today public intellectuals, people out there sort of throwing ideas out and hoping that they would catch on. And one of the neat things that I kept encountering, and you see this over and over again in the relationship between the two, is they'll have some playful joust on TV, and then they'll say, yeah, maybe we should retire for a drink somewhere, and we can talk a little bit more in depth about this. We can get to the bottom of your conservatism, Buckley, or we can get to the bottom of your left-wing radicalism, Mailer, and we can figure out what it is that drives this. They sort of wanted to learn from each other as much as they wanted to spar with each other. And so there was this sort of textured richness to their conversations that I just found fascinating, and I could really see them come to life as intellectuals when they did this.
Talk a little bit about ego of each man and how when it came to their relationship that it seemed to be that they were equals.
They both were men of substantial ego, that is for sure. They both grew up sort of being praised for being the smartest guy in the room throughout their whole life. Buckley was done so by his father and by all of the classmates he had growing up. He sort of carried a pomposity with him because he knew he was absolutely right. Mailer, of course, was heralded as the smartest school to come out of the public schools in Brooklyn where he grew up. So from a very early age, both of these guys were heralded as being some of the brightest lights coming of their generation. And then when they met, it was sort of a clash of egos in a lot of ways. And that you can sort of see that in the initial conversations where they're sort of battling each other, sort of two big lions are circling each other, trying to figure out how they can find the other person's weak spot. And over time, they grow to respect each other, and they can make fun of the fact that they both have these enormous egos. I'm reminded of the first time Norman Mailer was on William Buckley's television show, Firing Line. Buckley said, you know, wouldn't the communists be more afraid of a Buckley administration as opposed to a Mailer administration? And Mailer just laughed, and he said, well, I'm glad I'm not the only egoist in the room.
When it comes to Norman Mailer, and obviously here was a man, at least compared to Buckley, who was tabloid fodder and had a lot of baggage that he would carry with him. There were drunken fights. There was stabbing. There were all of these events that took place. How did Buckley react to that, and did that have any impact on the friendship and the relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. One interesting thing about that exact point is that before Buckley got to know Mailer, he sort of understood all of Mailer's crazy antics, the stabbing of his wife in 1960, the headbutting that he got into headbutting competitions through his younger years, all this sort of foolishness. He sort of dismissed it as, well, that's what happens when you let go of all of the traditional anchors that we hold on to, whether it's Christianity or family or anything like that. But as he got to know Mailer better, he realized that this was a part of the philosophy that Mailer was not only living by, but also trying to preach to the United States. And it was sort of a philosophy centered on sort of existentialism in some ways, but mostly about the fact that American life had become so corporatized, so consumed with consumerism, so preoccupied with status, sort of your standard 1950s white picket fence. And Mailer's antics were really a way to push Americans beyond this, to get them to realize that there was something deeper that humans needed to have to live by. There was some sort of authenticity was a word that he liked to use, that Americans were forsaking in the post-war world, and he was trying to get them back to that in his own sort of rambunctious kind of way. And Buckley really came to appreciate that, and as early as 1963, 64, you begin to see Buckley defending the antics of Norman Mailer in his public speeches, in National Review. So he really became a defender of what Norman Mailer was trying to do. He didn't necessarily become a convert to what Mailer was trying to do, but he definitely understood it, and he began to appreciate it for what it was, not just schoolboy antics.
This book has a hell of a cast list.
Yes.
Some very interesting characters.
Oh, it was a lot of fun to write just because these guys were so central to the cultural and intellectual and political life that they got to know so many of these key people. One of the characters who comes up several times throughout the book is James Baldwin, and he becomes sort of a foil for both men as they think through what's happening with the civil rights movement in the mid-1960s. Barry Goldwater's in there. Even Richard Nixon appears a couple times. LBJ is in there. But also guys like Truman Capote and Gore Vidal and Gloria Steinem shows up and Germaine Greer. So it does become sort of this 1960s intellectual life parade. And it was so much fun to write because I didn't have to go looking for these characters. These characters just come into the picture, and there's a cache of letters, and there's a public debate, and then Buckley will comment on Mailer's public debate and vice versa. And it just sort of lent itself to meeting these wonderful, dynamic, fascinating characters that really give a great texture to the 1960s intellectual life.
The subtitle of the book is The Difficult Friendship That Shaped the 60s. This relationship obviously went on several decades after. What was the nature of it after some of the spotlight started to dim?
Yeah, well, what happened, and sort of one of the stories of the book is what happens in the 1960s. That was kind of the story that I really set out to tell, was I really wanted to find a way to understand the transformations of the 1960s. I mean, I'd taught it a million times to my students, but I really wanted to get a deeper sense of the big changes that went on in American intellectual life and in the set of assumptions that Americans carried with them. And how I began to understand the late 1960s was that sort of the broad set of assumptions that Americans lived by, sort of a nice, friendly corporate capitalism, a staunch position towards the Cold War, everybody following these cultural rules is what I call them, the rules, that began to be challenged and totally transformed. And a new set of assumptions came up in the 1970s. And when that happened, it took Mailer and Buckley the bulk of the 1970s in some ways to recalibrate, to realize that in some ways their radical longings from the 1950s and 1960s had caused this dramatic, or helped cause, I should say, had helped cause this dramatic transformation in the way Americans thought of the world around them and themselves. And so their lives became sort of, I don't want to say smaller, but they became more circumspect. They began to focus on different things. They no longer felt comfortable speaking on behalf of the entire nation like they had in the 50s and 60s. And Mailer goes on to write sort of really marvelous books, but on smaller topics such as A Murder in Utah and this dynamic 1979 book that he writes. And Buckley picks up the novel as a form for the first time in the 1970s. And I really began to see that transition in the 70s as them sort of recalibrating to the ramifications of all the changes of the 1960s. And so their friendship changed too. They were no longer the leading figures, or some of the leading figures, making arguments on behalf of the country. They began to see each other socially a bit more. They began to go to fashion shows together and things like that. But they were no longer brought together to debate the destiny of America.
As they became older men, how often would they communicate with one another?
It's hard to tell. There were letters back and forth, and sometimes the letters would say things like, it was great to see you last week, I just wanted to follow up. So they definitely remained in contact with each other throughout the 70s. One of my favorite pieces of archival material that I found was from the middle 1970s, and a charity organization in New York was auctioning off a day with William F. Buckley, and they asked Norman Mailer to present Buckley to the bidders. So he wrote this really hilarious two-page, single-spaced introduction to William Buckley, and he made fun of what was so easy to make fun of in William Buckley, was this expansive vocabulary. So there's two pages of stuff that you can barely understand because the vocabulary is so off the wall. And he sent a clean copy of that to Buckley, and he said to him, "For yours to frame or flip away." And Buckley writes back, and he says, "Well, thanks, I'm going to have it framed. Let's get together sometime soon." So they definitely carried on this playful, engaging relationship with each other, and they saw each other quite a bit.
Well, the book is fascinating. It's Buckley and Mailer, The Difficult Friendship That Shaped the 60s. The book is published by Norton. Kevin Schultz, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Buckley and Mailer. It is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.